So, Will.
Yes?
This week's movie, I believe, kicked off an era of asking the question, what if Sherlock Holmes was sexy?
Yeah, it just barely kicks it off because the Cumberbatch show starts the next year.
So it must have already been in production then, I guess.
Yeah, but it's like something in the ether, and they were the first to get to it. Elementary starts in 2012.
That one that definitely exists.
Mark, Elementary ran for 7 seasons.
I know, it's absurd. I think my mom watched it.
154 episodes.
I just like Joan Watson.
Hey, if Lucy Liu wants to get a network salary, I'm not mad about it.
Not at all. But this movie adds the added twist of what if Sherlock Holmes was like also fun and not like the character in the books at all, basically.
It's so funny reading like interviews with the people involved in making it, because this is like the beginnings of the high era of like a million movie blogs that would send a bunch of people on junkets. That era that runs from like 2008, 2009-ish till like roughly like 2019, right? The end of Avengers and the end of Game of Thrones in that same
right.
year. And producers, writers, Guy Ritchie, we're all talking about like, yeah, there's this stuff where like Holmes will refer to these fights off screen where he'll be like, oh, if it wasn't for my skill with a stick, like I wouldn't have been able to get away. And now we're taking those and we're putting them on screen. And I'm like, first of all, I don't think Holmes referred to fights that often. Second of all, I don't think that's what appealed to anybody about those stories.
I mean, if there's one thing you're going to keep in your sexy, edgy reboot of Sherlock Holmes, it should be the crippling cocaine addiction.
Which they allude to. But this is a PG-13 movie.
Right. I think full-blown white powder on the nose at all times if you're going to make a Sherlock Holmes like this.
There is, like, a lot of subtext to that, though, if you're going to put Robert Downey Jr. in it in 2009.
You know what? That's fair enough, and maybe you don't want to go that route.
We're going to have to talk about, like, the Downey of it all in a little bit.
But it does beg the question, in an continuing, I would say, era of the edgy, sexy reboot, what is some of your favorite entries into this grand tradition?
I mean, we could talk about other things first. What I particularly like about Sherlock Holmes with it is the tradition of edgy, sexy reboots of public domain characters.
Oh, yes.
Like, that's the particularly funny thing about it to me, because that's where they're trying to say, nobody owns this, so we can just do it, but we're going to do the cool version.
Well, I mean, we got the horror Winnie the Pooh movie last year.
Okay, that's not quite what I mean, but, like, yes, there are the people who, like, anytime something enters the public domain, they do a horror version. I'm sure Horror Steamboat Willie is coming. No, I mean, like, movie studios, not, like, dummies on the internet. Where, like, in the period since Sherlock Holmes came out, we have had 2 gritty Robin Hood remakes.
Oh my god, how could I forget?
There's the Russell Crowe one, directed by Ridley Scott, that I kind of liked at the time, and I'd be curious to revisit it. I feel like the reputation was, it is boring and he is barely Robin Hood in it. And I was taking AP Euro and was like, this movie's about Magna Carta! And then, of course, the great Taron Egerton Robin Hood movie that is about the war in Iraq.
Which?
In which?
We have an episode on.
Robin Hood gets drafted.
Oh my god.
And he comes back to court the youth vote.
The machine gun arrows.
Similarly, the Dark Universe Mummy. Mummy's a public domain concept. But what if they were dark?
Is the mummy in the public domain now? It can't be. Like the 1932 version.
The Universal film is not in the public domain.
But
the concept
of
a mummy.
That's not even public domain. That's just a thing.
But like, that's the weird thing where like, we treat those like classic monster things as though they are proprietary Universal things. But they're not. Like, the concept of a wolfman is not owned by Universal, right? Frankenstein is not owned by Universal.
The Swamp Thing might be.
Well, Swamp Thing is a DC Comics character.
Or
you're thinking the creature
from
the
Black
Lagoon.
Lagoon.
I don't know who owns that. I don't think that's Universal. It might be.
But it's
that movie's good. Have you seen Black
I
Lagoon?
I have not.
That movie
that's
rocks.
From the 50s, though. That's post-30s.
Yes. If you want to get into like comic book stuff, the 2010s are the era of the Snyderverse.
Oh, yes.
Right? What if Superman was dark and brooding?
Batman Begins and all that.
Well, that's earlier. That feels separate to this from me, except that it kind of plays a role in tipping it off, right? So Dark Knight is 2008.
I think the difference is Dark Knight is, like, good, has something to say, and accomplishes what it's trying to do.
Right. Whereas, like, the Josh Trank Fantastic Four movie thinks it has a lot to say by making sunny science optimists into, like, tools of the U.S. military. But, in fact, it has very little to say and is boring. The Superman one is the biggest one. Like, making Superman a, like, brooding sad boy is, like, kind of the ultimate example of this thing you're getting.
It just, like, fundamentally misunderstands.
Right. I think Man of Steel is an all right movie, but it's a dreadful Superman movie.
Now, obviously, the best examples of this live on television in Riverdale.
Riverdale's a good example of getting back to the energy of Sherlock Holmes.
Right. That's getting back to this. That's what if we took some of America's most, like, notoriously wholesome characters and put them in a sexy teen drama centered on murder with hints of incest.
Okay, but the context that you don't have is that Riverdale is a post-Afterlife with Archie story. And Afterlife with Archie was this, like, hit comic series. It ran for basically across two miniseries, which was about, like, the Archie crew plus zombies.
But are they sexy?
No, but, like, what happened is, like, somewhere around that point, around, like, the late aughts or early 2010s, new leadership took over at Archie Comics and was like, what if we try some new stuff? So they did Afterlife with Archie. They did, like, a couple of other new miniseries. This series called Life with Archie that tried to kind of crank up the drama in a Riverdale-y kind of way. They also did, like, some reboots of stuff. I think, like, Mark Waid and Fiona Staples did the main book. Chip Zdarsky did the Jughead comic. So, like, they were trying to, like, make Archie Comics kind of cool and trendy, and that became the basis then of turning it into Riverdale.
Yeah. That sort of tracks, but it is just, like, so weird.
I'd never seen a minute of it, but I loved any time I heard about
it. The perfect show to have food poisoning to.
Right, you've talked about this before.
Yeah. If you have food poisoning, highly recommend watching all of season one of Riverdale.
I've told this story about Chip Zdarsky, I think, on a podcast. He had done this Jughead miniseries where Jughead was established to be asexual. And then after that, he heard there was an Archie show in development. And he was like, oh, maybe, like, they'll use some of my Jughead show. And as he told it, he was like, then I heard it was on the CW. And I was like, oh, no, those kids are banging.
And boy, are they.
We have not discussed Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters yet.
Oh, that opens up the whole world of the, like, Jack and the Beanstalk one.
Was that, like, dark and gritty and cool, though? I didn't see that.
I think it was. You also have the, like...
Snow White and the Huntsman, of course.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. That's what I was trying to pull. Charlize Theron is the evil queen who has crow powers. Maleficent.
Right, Maleficent, though, is more kinda of, different. Like... That's part of the Disney live-action thing, where... The Disney live-action trend starts with Alice in Wonderland, Tim Burton. And, like, that is not a remake of the Disney movie. That is, like, a different Alice in Wonderland thing. They take a while to get to the point of, like, just straight-up remaking their movies. Because they do Alice in Wonderland, they do Maleficent, they do Pete's Dragon. And, like, the first one that is, like, close to being a remake is Cinderella. But even that one is, like... really kind of going for a different thing. That brand of Cinderella isn't a musical, so they're not just, like, recreating sequences wholesale. It uses, like, some of the iconography, but is its own thing. It's not till The Jungle Book in 2016 that they just do a straight remake.
Yeah. I do think that the, like, sexy gritty reboot probably helped kick that off with the Alice in Wonderland.
So Alice in Wonderland is
2010,
like, March,
right?
It's March 2010. So it opens, like, 3 months after this movie.
Yeah. So it's in that same ethos era.
Yeah.
Ether.
You know it's around the same time because Avatar was in theaters for this movie and that movie.
Oh my god. I mean, I will say the, like, quote-unquote gritty reboot can be done well, and a special shout-out to our girl Alicia Vikander in Tomb Raider.
I gotta tell you, I caught that movie on TV a while ago, and commercial breaks where you can think about what you're seeing do not help that movie.
No, I'm sure they don't. But that's not how it's meant to be watched.
I guess not.
You are supposed to see it. You're supposed to be so on the edge of your seat that she says, oh, a color puzzle. And you say, you're so right, girl.
Yeah, that movie on rewatch is duller than I remember when we were discovering it together in theaters. A trait that this movie has in common with it.
Yeah. I mean, that movie is very much, like, perfect for watching in theaters with your friend.
And especially, like, with no investment because you MoviePassed into it.
Yeah. I think if I had paid for that
I
wouldn't have been mad. I'm a GOG dog.
I'm sorry, you are what?
A Walton Goggins fan. A GOG dog.
A GOG dog. You've been watching Vice Principals, right?
Yeah, I've watched a few episodes. I'm also excited to see him as a ghoul in the Fallout show.
I'm trying to think where else you might see Walton Goggins that you haven't. You could watch Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I'm good. I first met him watching season one of Justified, which is a good show. I gotta
Walton
say.
Goggins had a moment around the time of like Vice Principals where he was like getting a lot of Hollywood villain roles.
Have you watched Justified?
No, I know I need to. 2018 alone, he has Tomb Raider, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and Maze Runner the Death Cure.
Good for him.
Yeah. He's quite good in Hateful Eight. He's a good fit for Tarantino.
Do you know who the season two arch villain of Justified is? I want to say it's season two.
I do not.
Esteemed character actress Margot Martindale plays the outwardly kindly head of, like, the Southern Mafia.
That rocks. I love that. Oh, dang. Walton Goggins is checking in.
What?
He's going on a trip to the White Lotus.
Oh my god. That's incredible.
That's not coming out till next year, but
I think
oh
we've, like, Vice Principals kind of unlocked the not just in part two. It demonstrated the not just, like, Hollywood villain type role that he has with Justified and Tomb Raider, but also you can put him in the real world, too.
Right. Uncle Baby Billy is a very measured, realistic performance of the kind that you want to see.
Unfortunately, probably some people are out there like Uncle Baby Billy.
Well, sure. I put There'll Come a Payday on my, like, folk music playlist, so every once in a while it'll just crop up on Spotify.
Misbehavin' is a jam.
You told me you were going to play that at your wedding, and you didn't.
If you haven't seen Righteous Gemstones, you should, dear audience.
What a good show.
You know what's not that good?
Sherlock Holmes.
This week's movie. Welcome to We Love the Love, a Hollywood romance podcast. I'm Mark and I'm Yay.
And I'm Will and I'm a Ginger. This is an investigative podcast, much like Sherlock Holmes. We've got to solve a problem. And this problem is, does Hollywood romance actually make any sense?
And are these people actually dateable or even likable?
It doesn't matter if the romance is a main plot or a one-scene flirtation, or if it kind of like comes and goes as the people remember that women are in the movie. We will dig in and see what's there, as though we're uncovering a corpse of a guy who was mysteriously murdered. We're talking about the romance of Guy Ritchie's 2009 cool fighting Sherlock Holmes.
Honestly, the closest thing to the source material, well, I mean, we'll talk about Watson. Like, let's just remove Jude Law from the equation.
Jude Law innocent.
The closest thing to the source material in this movie is its disregard of the concept of women.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing is, it's funny how Irene Adler looms so large over, like, the Sherlock Holmes fandom. Like, Sherlock Holmes fans love talking about Irene Adler. People who have written other Holmes stories since Conan Doyle's death bring her in all the time. She's only in one story.
She's referenced in, like, four others, though.
Yeah.
And she is genuinely, I think, the only person who outsmarts Holmes.
That's what's fun about her.
I fully understand and am supportive of bringing her into other properties.
Totally.
I think the concept of making her this, like, arch criminal is kind of weird because in the book, she's mostly just, like, a very smart actress who outsmarts Sherlock Holmes and the King of Bohemia, which...
It's a scandal.
Didn't really exist at this time. The King of Bohemia. It's just, like... The Austro-Hungarian Emperor.
Scandal in Bohemia is published in 1891. Yeah, there is no King of Bohemia.
The King of Bohemia stopped the, like, that's like the 1700s, I would imagine, or earlier. It was probably a title they still claimed.
Okay, Bohemia was never a kingdom, it was a duchy. And
no, it was a kingdom within the Holy Roman Empire, I thought.
Okay, I'm seeing Yes, there was a Kingdom of Bohemia basically until like roughly Napoleon times. So before Conan Doyle's lifetime. And then it was under personal union with the Habsburgs before it was just like folded into the dual monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Medieval history is so funny.
Yeah, because I've been to Prague Castle.
That's very cool.
And it's feels royal.
Anyway, Sherlock Holmes. Where do you come in from Sherlock Holmes? What's your backstory?
I watched this in theaters, I think. And
we can even go more broadly, like Holmes in general.
Holmes in general. Honestly, this was probably the first Holmes exposure I had.
Oh.
I tried reading Hound of the Baskervilles in like third grade, maybe, and was like, I don't understand what this means because I'm a child and this was written in the 1800s.
That is the best intro one, but maybe not for a third grader.
And then I kind of just left it. And then I watched this movie. Then I was really into Sherlock, the Cumberbatch one, season one. Both of these were properties that I didn't want to revisit because I remembered enjoying them. I'm willing to take that fall for the pod on this movie, and I was correct to be nervous. But I would be curious about the Sherlock show.
Yeah, I probably watched 2 seasons of that.
Me too. I gave up. I was not like a huge super fan.
I liked it. I'm a big Sherlock Holmes fan. 90-minute episodes, I'd just rather watch a movie.
I mean, yeah. So this came out, if this came out in 2009, I probably would have seen this in theaters in Singapore. And Sherlock was also showing while I was in high school. And so I was very used to watching British TV because, you know, there's a lot of that out in the Commonwealth. So the 90-minute show, I wasn't that shocked by.
Yeah, I was a big Sherlock Holmes fan. I think probably the first Sherlock Holmes thing I saw was the Hound of the Baskervilles episode of Wishbone.
Well, I mean, if we're going into, like, Sherlock Holmes parody, and, like, yeah, that's the kind of... That was my exposure before this.
Right, where Wishbone wears a deerstalker hat.
But I think I have... I think I read Hound of the Baskervilles for school, maybe?
Oh.
And I have read a decent amount of Sherlock Holmes stories. I bought at Barnes & Noble...
The big book.
The big book, yeah. The, like, yeah. Leather-bound one that was only $20.
Yeah, I have that, too. And I, like, in middle school and high school, read... Not all of it, but I read most of the Holmes stuff. I really liked it. My family and I, we watched a lot of the Jeremy Brett Holmes, the TV show from the 80s. And Jeremy Brett is, like, the best Sherlock Holmes. He rocks.
Oh, I've also seen The Great Mouse Detective.
Yes, of course, Basil of Baker Street. So, yeah, so I'm all in on Holmes. I love Holmes. When this movie was coming out, it was huge for me because it was Holmes and, of course, it was Iron Man.
Oh, yeah, you would have been sold.
Right. And, like, that is kind of interesting to me because this Sherlock Holmes is, like, a Robert Downey Jr. star vehicle. And it's kind of the only successful, and it is successful, it's a big hit, example of a superhero star in this era parlaying a hit superhero movie into, like, now come see me, the star of that, in another movie. Where, like, when Chris Hemsworth goes to do, like, Rush or In the Heart of the Sea or something like that, like, people don't go see those movies, right? When Chris Evans does another movie, people don't go see those. Nobody goes to see, like, Cherry for Tom Holland.
But Robert Downey Jr., of course, has a different trajectory, where he was previously famous and also was in the first one.
That's the thing. I think that's what it is at the time Sherlock Holmes comes out, there have been 2 MCU movies, and most people only saw one of them.
And also, I mean, you got people like my mom who are just like, they remember Robert Downey Jr. from when they were young, and they're
like on TV.
On TV, and they were really happy to see him doing better for himself.
Right. This is like, I think it was Richard Lawson on Little Gold Men who said that Downey's Oscar win for Oppenheimer is kind of the climax of like a 16-year comeback. That like, he goes to prison for drug possession, like violating parole, possession of an unlicensed firearm. He serves a little over a year actually in prison, comes out, has a hard time getting back to work because he can't get insured, and then is like gradually getting back into it, where like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is like the step one of the comeback. Iron Man is this thing where he and Marvel are kind of meeting in the middle because Marvel needs a cheap star and he needs a movie that will hire him. So they do that and it works out great for both of them. He parlays that into this, and like The two Sherlock Holmes movies are hits, but he gets in this weird rut where initially he can get that star thing going, but once the Marvel engine really takes off, people stop going to see him in other things, right? Everyone's like, well, I can get Downey every other year in an Iron Man movie or an Avengers movie or heck, a Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
So I don't need to go see him in other stuff. So like, people see this, they see Sherlock Holmes 2, they do not go see The Judge.
Well, that's probably for the best.
So he does the Marvel thing for 11 years. After Endgame, he makes Doolittle. People also do not go see that.
Well, he should try making good movies.
He should try making good movies. Right, but so then, like, he does, right? He makes Oppenheimer, and, like, he's not the star of Oppenheimer. He's not what's bringing people to the table there. But the whole attitude of Downey's awards campaign was like, boy, it's nice to be in something good.
Yeah, it's like, people are almost seem surprised when people don't want to see bad movies and want to see good movies.
Right, but there was this whole attitude of, like, there was this celebratory air to his awards campaign, especially his Oscars win, of, like, you made it back. You are back in the limelight. All is well. And he's starring in the new Park Chan-wook is making a TV show for HBO that's going to be out this year, and it stars Downey in, like, 6 different roles.
My God. And the people who watched him on TV before he, you know, had his run-in with the law seem very happy for him to be doing better.
Yeah. But, like, that to me is part of what makes Sherlock Holmes interesting, is it's this, like, singular moment where a Marvel star, before Marvel star meant something as a brand, is able to parlay another success off of their stardom.
And, you know, part of that, he's basically just playing the same character.
But, like, that's movie star stuff, right?
I know. It is. But it's also just weird because it definitely fits Iron Man better than it does Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think the characterization is the problem with this movie. I think the problem with this movie is that it's kind of boring.
It is boring.
I really liked this movie when it came out. I was like, they did it. They made a cool Sherlock Holmes movie. And I remember talking to a teacher about it because I was in high school. I was like, yeah, Sherlock Holmes, it was good. And the teacher said what I thought was interesting at the time, and now I think may have been an insult, which was, yeah, it kind of felt like if Sherlock Holmes was a comic book.
Yeah, that's a slice.
Which, for what it's worth, they did. The story was developed by Michael Robert Johnson and Lionel Wigram, who's the producer. And they did not put together a spec script. They put together a comic book.
Classic.
That actually is, like, kind of becoming increasingly common and is very controversial in the comics world.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's like, there's a lot of resentment of the idea that comics are, like, stage one of a creative process, that they're not a legitimate art form in themselves. And, like, people, when they have a movie pitch, rather than pitching it traditionally, will, like, make a comic effectively as a storyboard to be like, look what this will look like.
Well, that's kind of what I was picturing less as, like, a fully developed piece of art comic book and more of just, like, a storyboard, but more involved.
I think that's what they did in this case, but today there is a real trend of, like, comics that are clearly published just to be optioned as movies.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah, actually, Mark Millar, who is one of, like, the big comics creators of the 2000s, he's Scottish. He created stuff like Kick-Ass, and Kingsman is him too. But, like, his comics, he owns a comics publisher, and they are now owned by Netflix.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. Like, clearly just as, like, an engine for making Netflix series.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really care for that as much. But this movie, it feels like a attempt at a comic book movie without being, like, a published comic first.
It's trying to have the energy of a cool comic book movie from the first era of comic book movies, right? The Sam Raimi Spider-Man era, yeah. the Batman Begins era.
I have never seen my love, Rachel McAdams, so poorly used in a movie.
They don't have anything to do with her.
They don't know how to use her at all, and it's so upsetting. Like, every time she's on screen, I'm like, I hate that you're here. And I've never felt that way before.
It's also the problem of Irene Adler is just not an essential character in the Holmes universe. They decided to add her in part to seed the next movie, in part to have, like, a woman involved in the business of the movie. But, like, the whole thing about Holmes is the dynamic of Holmes and Watson. And, like, they never found a way to make that a three-person dynamic.
No. Irene Adler is best, like, when she exists as an idea. Like when
the woman, as Holmes often calls her.
Right. And it's like, again, I haven't seen it. I remember Irene Adler in A Scandal in Belgravia, the first episode of Sherlock, to be
is
like,
it Belgravia?
Yeah.
Like in the Princess Switch?
No, the real neighborhood of London that is called Belgravia, based on Belgrave Street, I think.
Oh, okay.
It is where Buckingham Palace is, like the neighborhood where Buckingham Palace is.
Well, that makes sense, because A Scandal in Bohemia is about stealing a giant royal gem.
Right. So, I think she's probably better used there, but I also haven't seen it. But I don't remember particularly loving the Irene Adler part, even when I liked this movie after watching it.
I have no memory of any opinion. I thought the fighting was cool. I thought, like, Holmes, like, calculating his way through a fight was cool. And now I'm like, I see what you're going for, but, like, is that what I want from Sherlock Holmes?
Right.
Look,
it's
on some level,
so over the top, too.
On some level, the movie was a success, because in 2009, I was a teenage boy, and I paid to see the movie, and I bought the DVD. So, like, the fact that I look at it more critically, like, they already have my money.
I mean, yeah, it's a successful movie. One I just didn't really like that much watching this time around.
It made so much money.
It's weird, because I don't begrudge it that much.
No, it's fine. It's not a great movie. It's not dreadful. It's a little dull. There are moments that are cool. There are moments that are weird. Like, if this was the worst movie that came out, we'd be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense that it made a ton of money, too.
Yeah. It's got the Iron Man factor. It's also got the, like, opened on Christmas Day thing, which is a great time to open to make a lot of money, especially in 2009. Furthermore, it's opening in the Avatar, like, peak box office window before theater reservations were really a thing. So people are going to a movie. They're like, let's see Avatar. It's sold out. They go see Sherlock Holmes.
It's also, like, it was relatively new, too. Like,
the
style
gritty
wasn't
remake.
Super overdone.
In the way that it is by, like, the Edgerton Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Or when Guy Ritchie makes Arthur Legend of the Sword.
Yeah. Have you read The Crystal Cave? I think that's what it's called.
No, what is that?
It's, or Crystal Cavern something. It's, like, from the 70s. I can't remember. It's a book about Merlin told in very much the, like, Arthur as post Roman, but like Anglo-Roman fighting the Saxons in the 400s Britain. But
okay.
It's about Merlin. So, you know, it's like supposed to be kind of centered in Wales. It all takes place in Wales. And it makes it like less magic. There's still a bit of magic, but it actually is more of an adaptation of Geoffrey of Monmouth's like History of the Kings of Britain style.
Okay.
And I think that would be interesting to do as an Arthur movie, as like, here is what the 400s in Britain looks like with just a touch of magic, but it's kind of Roman and also some Saxons in it.
Oh yeah, I mean, we, as far as I'm concerned, we still have not had the great Arthur movie.
Yeah,
like the Green Knight is the closest, but that's Arthur adjacent.
I think Arthuriana could be, like, you could do good Arthuriana movies, but I think it would also be interesting to do the, like, Geoffrey of Monmouth Arthur, too.
Yeah.
It's, like, Arthur in the tradition of Roman Emperor. Anyway, that's a diversion.
Yeah. You should watch The Kid Who Would Be King. That's charming.
This movie, on the other hand, not that charming.
No, I mean, like,
what is, like, it's so weird, too. When you take a step back and talk about the plot of this movie.
Oh, I wasn't even getting that. I, like, some of the stuff, like, the fighting, the, like, slowed down fighting as Sherlock Holmes narrates over, like, okay, I punch him here, then I punch him there, planning it all out in advance.
This mustn't register on an emotional level. First, distract target. Then block his blind jab. Counter with cross to left cheek. Discombobulate. Dazed, he'll attempt wild haymaker. Employ elbow block and body shot. Block feral left. Weaken right jaw. Now fracture. Break cracked ribs. Traumatize solar plexus. Dislocate jaw entirely. diaphragm. In summary, ears ringing, jaw fractured, 3 ribs cracked, 4 broken, diaphragm hemorrhaging. Physical recovery, 6 weeks. Full psychological recovery, 6 months. Capacity to spit it back of head, utilized.
I'm, like, immune to that because that is part of the Warner Brothers commercial for the concept of Blu-rays. So if you throw on an early Warner Brothers Blu-ray and they have a commercial of, like, here's why Blu-ray is cool, one of the big things they were talking up was basically, like, picture-in-picture director's commentary where you could, like, watch Guy Ritchie explaining how they shot that.
Oh my god.
So, like, I've seen that scene way more than anything else in this movie. But you wanted to talk about the black magic of it, which I think is good and cool.
It is good and cool, but it's also so weird. And I also don't understand the end game here, because I feel like if a guy were to kill all of Parliament, I don't think the people of Britain would be that happy about it.
Well,
and just, like, support him.
I think their plan is to rule with might at that point.
In the 1890s, using magic to try and rule with might, I just don't see it working.
From the bridge construction, this would be late 80s or early 90s, yeah.
I think they say 1890 at one point.
Oh, maybe they do.
And so it's just like, I don't know, it feels kind of weird. It's almost like they think the 1890s were a lot more medieval than they may have actually been.
Okay, so the occult stuff, I like, as a premise, I don't mind, because, like, this is coming out of the 19th century spiritist movement, right?
Right.
Aleister Crowley hasn't happened yet. So, like, it is the middle of this sort of, like, general interest in the supernatural and, like, kind of an upper class interest in the occult. Kind of as a lark.
Right. That's the thing, is I don't think anyone was taking it seriously enough for it to actually influence their, like, the politics of the country as much as this movie would have us believe. The fact that this, like, weird, like, four horsemen or whatever the four angels, whatever this cult is called, is supposed to have run Britain for centuries.
Okay, so I don't think that's actually true. I think that is, like, cult propaganda.
Yeah.
Like, that's just nonsense. That's like the Stonecutters in The Simpsons.
Right.
But what I do believe is that, like, in this period of interest in, like, spiritism and stuff like that, people are going to join it or turn existing fraternal societies into more and more supernaturally coded sorts of things.
Yeah.
And I think the key turning point we have to take is the idea that, like, Mark Strong is seeking legitimacy. And as a literal illegitimate figure, and we're going to have to talk about the, like, how that works, that he is a lord, despite being the illegitimate son of a knight.
Yes, because that means he must have had, like, a whole, like, life in the spotlight, maybe in the military, something where he would have had to have been fully ennobled.
Right.
On his own.
Because his dad is a knight.
Yeah, sir.
So he outranks his dad despite being a bastard.
Unacknowledged. So, he got his lordship entirely on his own.
Yeah. But, like, I think he is seeking legitimacy through this organization. And he's, like, doing magic tricks, basically, to convince people of it. Like, that all makes a certain degree of sense to me.
It does. It's just the leap to, like, he's gonna use this to solidify one-man rule over the, like, British Empire in the 1890s and take over America is where you lose me.
There are details where he's like, the Americans are, he never says the United States, he's like, our former colony that rightly belongs to us. And I'm like, bud, by 1890, that could be Canada. But he says, like, yes, their recent civil war has made us weak. And I'm like, if it's 1890, civil war is 25 years ago, and the U.S. government came out stronger from the civil war.
Yeah, so it's just like, that leap is where I get lost.
Well, the plan to conquer the United States is obviously not a particularly good one. I don't think it's particularly well thought out. I think that's, like, a long-term goal, right?
Yeah. This movie did send me on a rabbit hole of looking into black magic laws in the UK.
I assumed this was just some old, like, Stuart-era law that had never been blown off the books.
So, that's what I thought, too. But then I looked, and they actually replaced it in 1753. because the witch hunting craze was like 1600 to the mid 1700s.
Yeah.
Not actually that long historically.
No.
They passed this law, and it, the point of the law is basically to say witchcraft doesn't actually exist, but it's illegal to steal money from people by pretending you do witchcraft.
That's very funny. Like, very enlightenment, right? You know, witchcraft's not real, but we still need to stop these people.
Right. That lasts until the 1950s, when it's replaced by a law about, like, fraudulent mediums and stuff like that.
Okay.
And so, in 1890, you would not be sentenced for practicing black magic, but you would be sentenced if he was charging people to do black magic, but, like, not in a fun way, I guess. This is where the law gets iffy to me, and I didn't actually do a lot of research, but at what point does becoming a medium become fraudulent? Because you have to prove that the person doesn't actually believe that they're a medium?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, I wonder if my problem is that the scale of this story is too large for Holmes. Holmes is not a saving the world guy. He's not a superhero.
No, Holmes is like...
At most, he would, like, save the monarchy, and even that feels too big.
The story I always think about is, it's called, like, The Speckled Rope or something, where they're just in a guy's house, people are dying, and it turns out it's a snake that a snake charmer trained.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it's good.
It's good. Like, that is the scale. The Hound of the Baskerville, people are dying at a guy's spooky house on the moors. Like,
yeah.
Holmes is a Poirot, a Marple type. He is a very, like, small scale, but very intelligent person.
The best one is the Redheaded League, which is the one where a guy comes to Holmes and is just like, I think something weird is going on in my life, and I don't know what the deal is. And Holmes like, okay, what's going on? And this man is like, there was an ad in the newspaper saying the Redheaded League was looking to hire people, and I have red hair and needed a job. So I showed up, and they just put me in a room and told me to copy out the encyclopedia. And every day I show up and copy the encyclopedia, and they pay me extremely well. And it turned out the whole thing was cover, like, while he was doing that, like, they had needed to rent the building and wanted it to seem like something legitimate was happening. And in the basement, they were digging into the bank next door.
I remember the one with, like, the pips.
That one is, like, fascinating as a piece of, like, remembering what the world was like when Conan Doyle was writing. Because the Five Orange Pips, the villains are the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
And, like, in the story, Holmes has to explain, like, oh, there's this group in America, they're bad. Because clearly, like, Conan Doyle just, like, read a newspaper article about the Klan one time and filed it away. But then has to explain to his British audience what he's talking about.
Yeah, the stories aren't as universal as sometimes they are portrayed to be. They are of their era.
Right, which but I appreciate about them.
Yeah.
Holmes only really goes abroad when Conan Doyle is trying to kill him.
Yeah, the only time he leaves Britain, I think, is to go die in Switzerland.
Right, because Doyle got sick of writing Sherlock Holmes stories, so he decided to write him off, threw him off the Reichenbach Fall, said, that's that. And, like, the original obnoxious fan campaign, the original fan-demanded reboot, was people harassed him so much that he's like, fine, I'll bring back Sherlock Holmes and write more stories.
You know what I think also may have helped? Money. He was like, I will make a lot of money. I guess I'll do it.
Have you ever read any other Doyle?
I've read The Lost World.
That's the one I've read too.
Weird.
Weird story. They find a plateau in South America, a really high plateau where dinosaurs live.
Yep.
There's a like early black and white movie of that, like made around the same time as King Kong.
It's also very much a post-Darwin book.
Yes. Where Doyle is like, I have a pretty good handle on how evolution works, right?
Yeah, I figured it out.
So, Sherlock Holmes, 2009, it's directed by Guy Ritchie, director mostly of action movies about British guys who like to box. Guy Ritchie, Mark, has made 6 movies in the last 5 years.
Damn.
So, yeah. Obviously, May 2019, he has the Disney remake of Aladdin.
Of course. That movie that so many people saw and get.
That movie made $1 billion.
It's wild that you could just make a movie that makes $1 billion and no one talks about it.
Yeah. So he made that. And then since then, he's made 5 other movies, which are all various versions of, like, a bunch of handsome British guys get in fights, like Operation Ruse de Guerre and The Gentleman. This week, around the time this episode's coming out, he has The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which is his World War II guys, like, box and explode things movie.
He knows what he likes, and he goes for it.
And he can make them quickly.
Clearly.
Yeah. The movie's written by Michael Robert Johnson, Anthony Peckham, and Simon Kinberg. Simon Kinberg attached to a lot of cursed franchises. They talked a lot about how they were, like, trying to find, like, new ways of depicting Holmes. They're like, we're sick of the Deerstalker hat. Once Wishbone wears it, that's it. They didn't say that. But they were like, we want to find, like, a different kind of look for him. A kind of bohemian Sherlock Holmes.
It's just odd.
But they get Downey. They get Rachel McAdams coming off of, like, a semi-career hiatus. She had, like, taken a couple years off. Jude Law, Lindsay Bad. They, in a, like, kind of surprising, innovative casting, they got Mark Strong as a villain.
Yeah, they're really pushing the boundaries there.
Yeah. Mark Strong, like, something about him, like, his Italian heritage really comes off in this movie.
Mark Strong getting described as Stanley Tucci's Malignant was very funny to me.
That is good. My favorite story about the making of this movie is that Hans Zimmer bought a $200 out-of-tune piano, took it to a garage, and beat it up some more, and then used it to write the score.
The music's good.
Yeah, it got an Oscar nomination. I remember this was a year where at the Oscars, they did, like, presentations of all the scores as, like, a medley featuring interpretive dance or something. And the Sherlock Holmes segment is cool. If you haven't seen it in a while, it's worth checking out.
Yeah, I think the things that work about this movie, the music and Jude Law as Dr. John Watson doing the best work in the movie.
I don't even dislike the Downey performance. I just wish there was more going on around it.
Yeah. Honestly, the Rachel McAdams, not because of her, but she drags down the Downey's yes. performance.
Because those scenes are really lacking in energy because there's, like, no point to them. Nothing right. of consequence ever happens in a scene with Irene Adler.
So that's annoying. But then Jude Law is, it's nice to see Watson as Watson is written in the books as, like, a competent sidekick who brings in his experience as a doctor and also a soldier.
Right. But, like, Watson is, like, really interested in all this. He enjoys doing it with Holmes. He is not someone who is reluctantly dragged along.
Except I think he does try and retire and, like, married in the books. So, like,
yeah.
It does make sense.
As we've said, Sherlock Holmes was a gigantic hit. It opened Christmas Day 2009 in second place behind James Cameron's Avatar. But in second place that first weekend, it made $62 million.
Good lord.
It made 209 domestic and another 289 overseas. It was the eighth highest grossing film of 2009, the sixth highest grossing movie never to hit number one at the box office.
That's a very interesting list.
Yeah, the other one never to hit number one at the box office. Number one is Illumination's Sing. Number two, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, legendarily. Number three, Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Squeakquel. Number four, Alvin and the Chipmunks. Number five, A Star is Born 2018.
A Star is Born never made it to number one?
No, it opened like the same time as like Venom.
That's so weird because that movie made such an impact.
Yeah, and it played for a long time. I mean, I saw it again in theaters in January after it opened in October. But yeah, it had a good, healthy run, but it never quite made it to number one. Do you want me to tell you, or do you want to guess the other top movies of 2009? A good year for this?
2009. Well, Avatar.
Number one.
Number one. I don't know. Iron Man 2 came out in 2010, right?
Yes. 2009 was a year without Marvel movies.
Wow. What a time.
Yeah. The only one since then without Marvel movies is 2020. Okay, number two at the box office is a Warner Brothers franchise. Iconic WB franchise. Their biggest one of this period.
Is Harry Potter still coming out?
Oh, yeah. No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that's Harry... Is that the last one?
No, the last one is 2011.
Oh, wow. So this is six?
Yeah, this is Half-Blood Prince. Number three is from a Fox animated franchise that I had tapped out on by this point.
Fox animated franchise?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Starring a number of TV stars, like Dennis Leary and Queen Latifah. Queen Latifah's also a TV star.
Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinosaur?
Absolutely. Number four, a Paramount franchise, second in a series that is still going. I wouldn't say going strong, but still going. Starring Shia LaBeouf, oh, Megan Fox.
Transformers, this what is number two, Rise of the Fallen?
Revenge of the Fallen.
Revenge of the Fallen.
I saw that with a bunch of my friends in high school. One of the girls walked out and said, Megan Fox's boobs should have gotten separate billing.
Good line.
Number five, a Roland Emmerich disaster movie set in the near future.
2012.
Yep. Number six, animated movie nominated for Best Picture that year.
Pixar?
Yep. This is the first year of 10 Best Picture nominees.
2009 Pixar. Is that Toy Story 3?
That was a Best Picture nominee, but the next year.
Okay. So Toy Story 3 before Up?
Yes, Up. Which wins for animated feature and I think wins for score as well. Number seven, another second installment in a franchise. This one from Summit Entertainment.
What is Summit Entertainment?
It no longer exists. It's now part of Lionsgate. But this franchise made it seem like Summit was maybe going to be a big player.
Who's in it?
You know, some of our great movie stars of right now really start to level up in this movie, in this series. But they were not really getting good notices for these movies, which were generally looked down upon.
I don't know.
We covered the first one on the podcast.
Oh. Like, that helps me, Will.
This one's directed by Chris Weitz. Notably, the male lead doesn't really appear in this one very much because they introduce a different male lead.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
You might get a t-shirt to indicate which one you think the female lead should
date. Oh, is this breaking... No. Eclipse?
Eclipse is three. This is New Moon.
New Moon.
Yeah. The peak of Team Edward, Team Jacob times.
Indeed.
Number eight, Sherlock Holmes. Number nine is a Tom Hanks star vehicle, a franchise we should do one of. Deeply silly, but takes itself seriously at times. It's based on a novel, a spinoff of like the biggest hit novel of the 2000s, which was also previously adapted with Tom Hanks.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about Ron Howard's Angels and Demons.
Oh my god, yes. We should do Da Vinci Code.
We gotta do one of those.
We should just put it on the schedule.
Number 10 is the Golden Globe winner for Best Musical or Comedy for this year.
I don't know. That's not helpful.
Directed by future Best Director nominee Todd Phillips.
Oh god, Todd Phillips in 2009. That's like... He didn't do Step Brothers, but...
No, that's Adam McKay. Also a future Best Director nominee.
I don't know. Which Todd Phillips was it?
The Hangover.
The Hangover. That was pretty fun, at least yeah. When I watched it.
I should watch it again. I don't have a lot of memory. I brought up that Golden Globes in part because Downey wins the Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy.
Oh, I would have given it to Jude Law for supporting over Downey Jr. for lead, probably.
Yeah, Jude Law does not crack the supporting category, but that is a combined category where Christoph Waltz wins right. For Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, if it's combined, no chance.
Yeah, Downey wins over Matt Damon for The Informant, a fun nomination. Daniel Day-Lewis for Nine, an unhinged nomination. Joseph Gordon-Levitt for 500 Days of Summer, and Michael Stuhlbarg for A Serious Man. I might give it to Damon out of those.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I love that performance. That movie's, like... great until it runs too long, but yeah. I love that performance.
Yeah, should we start talking about the romance?
I think we should. Yeah, it's a Sherlock Holmes story. There's like a weird black magic element to it where Mark Strong is pretending to be a sorcerer. We don't really have to get into it.
It's all science.
Yeah.
I just like how the big like black magic he's gonna do is chemical warfare.
I mean, it's such a trope, but I kind of love it. Every time someone does a, like, late 19th century story where, like, the twist is like, oh my god, World War One is gonna happen.
Well, you've seen the second one, I assume.
Not since theaters.
The second one is just, like, Moriarty is a war profiteer who's trying to make World War One happen.
Great. That's where, like, even then, like, the second Fantastic Beasts movie, they're like, oh no, World War Two is gonna happen. And I'm like, you have magic, do something.
Well, okay, so every week we break down the romantic plotline of a movie into 5 points to guide conversation. Will you take us to point number one?
Okay, so point number one, at the start of this movie, Watson is preparing to move out of his shared home with Sherlock Holmes at 221B Baker Street. I would say this is not the most homoerotic Holmes-Watson relationship, but it's up there.
It's up there.
In a way that I enjoy.
Yeah.
The codependence is high.
The codependence is high. I think this movie does walk a fine line of where it is much more like, I think the Sherlock show took it farther. This one, it's really just like, it feels like codependence with some undertones.
Right. Like, you, it is a very easy read of this movie that, like, Holmes has, like, an unrequited love for Watson. Like, that's a very easy reading of this. Whereas, like, the Jeremy Brett Holmes, like, they are good professional friends.
Right. The jilted lover vibe he gives is pretty strong when he deals with Mary.
And I imagine Downey was not unaware of that.
No, absolutely not.
So, the issue is Watson is moving out because he is going to marry Mary Morstan, played by Kelly Riley, and therefore does not want to continue living in squalor with Sherlock Holmes. He wants to live with his nice wife and continue his medical practice. Holmes has not actually met Mary. We're told that Holmes has been avoiding her, almost like trying to deny that this is happening. We're told that Watson still has not proposed. It's implied that it's been for a while, and his reason is he hasn't found the right ring.
Dumb.
Yes, silly, a little anachronistic. Fixation on diamond rings in particular was a 20th century thing.
That was an ad concept.
Right.
That we all got suckered by.
But even, like, the engagement ring thing is not such a norm that Watson couldn't have just proposed. But Watson finally gets Holmes to go to dinner and meet with Mary. And in this scene, Mary, like, starts off, like, pretty game. She's like, I'm gonna meet my soon-to-be fiancé's famous but weird friend. And it's gonna be okay.
Yeah. She does her best.
She's even kind of flirty. Like, she asks Holmes to show off, like, how he evaluates people that he hasn't met. And so he's going to demonstrate using Watson. And he says, take Watson. And she says, I intend to. Like, it's a little forward.
She's claiming her man.
Yeah.
She knows that there's jealousy happening.
Right. She's here with the competition. She's like, to be clear, I will take him.
Right.
But Holmes decides to show off by, like, sort of stripping her down analytically.
You're a governess.
Well done.
Yes, well done. Shall we? Waiter.
Your student. It's a boy of age.
Charlie, 7, actually.
Ah. Finished tall for his age. He flicked in kitchen today.
Is there ink on my face?
There's nothing wrong with your face.
There are 2 drops on your ear, in fact. India blue is nearly impossible to wash off. Anyway, a very impetuous act by the boy, but you're too experienced to react rashly, which is why the lady for whom you worked lent you that necklace. Oriental pearls, diamonds, a flawless ruby, hardly the gems of governors. However, the jewels you are not wearing tell us rather more.
Holmes.
You were engaged. The ring has gone, but the lighter skin where it once sat suggests that you spent some time abroad wearing it proudly. That is, until you were informed of its true and rather modest worth, at which point you broke off the engagement and returned to England for better prospects. Doctor, perhaps.
Right on all counts, Mr. Holmes, apart from one. I didn't leave him. He died.
She threw wine all over Holmes, and now she doesn't like Sherlock Holmes.
Fair enough.
Yes, this is a reasonable reaction.
And also, it is, he, like, says it later, but it's even clear in that moment that, like, John knows.
Right. Yeah, he's, like, so exhausted just when Holmes starts going down this path.
Right.
We should mention, we have not gotten into this. Sherlock Holmes leaves this to go to a fight club.
Yeah. I guess it's how he makes money?
Yeah, it is implied that this is a big way he makes money, and also that Watson gambles regularly on Holmes's fights.
Or, I got the impression that Holmes uses Watson money to gamble on his fights.
That might be it. Nonetheless, Holmes is in a fight club.
So weird.
But in point number 2, Holmes, like, wakes up in his horribly messy rooms on Baker Street and discovers Rachel McAdams, Irene Adler, like, rooting through his stuff.
Thought we might have a little tea party. And while I was setting the table, I found this. A file with my name on it. Theft of Velasquez's portrait from King of Spain. Missing naval documents lead to resignation of Bulgarian Prime Minister. Scandalous affair and engagement of Habsburg Prince to Romanov Princess.
I was simply studying your methods, should the authorities ask me to hunt you down.
Ah. But I don't see my name in any of these articles.
But your signature was clear. Is that the Maharaja's missing diamond? Or just another souvenir?
Let's not dwell on the past. Shall we? Now, by the looks of things, I'd say you're between jobs.
And you're between husbands. How much did you get for the ring?
Oh, he was boring and jealous and ignored. I'm Irene Adler again.
It's flirty. Right off the bat.
He has her portrait sitting on a table. They have a whole conversation about her romantic status. He learns that she is between husbands.
Which, I will say, the portrait of her is actually a thing in the books.
Yes. That Holmes, like, keeps the portrait of the woman.
The woman.
Long after. But, like, it's clear that they explicitly have a romantic past. At one point, she talks about how, like, they stayed in some hotel together.
And also that she's, like, a world-famous criminal.
They mention, again, the incidents in Bohemia and this, like, big missing jewel that she's wearing around her neck.
Right. It's so weird.
It's so big. But that kind of establishes, like, Irene is around and she's enlisting Holmes to, like, find what happened to a guy who died.
Yeah. She doesn't know he's dead, though,
yeah,
at this point.
Just, like, find this guy. She's being cagey about who she works for because she's working for Professor Moriarty, the Napoleon of crime.
I love that phrase.
It's so good. But, you know, Holmes is, like, trying to track her down, figure out what's going on with her. But he's kind of hazy. He does eventually find the guy that she was looking for. He is dead. Because he is buried in Lord Blackwood's coffin.
Yeah, who's come back from the dead.
Right. He had been executed for black magic.
Also, 5 murders.
Right. It feels like that should be the priority. But black magic is listed first in the charges.
Yeah. It's weird.
This kind of brings us to point number 3.
Yeah.
Where Holmes has figured out, like, really shady stuff is going on. This guy that Irene told him to find has been murdered. Other people are turning up dead. Holmes fought a giant dude who threw barrels at him. It was basically a Donkey Kong game.
I also thought that.
Yes. So Irene catches Holmes breaking into her room at the hotel.
So, case closed. Which makes this a social visit?
No. It's a you're in over your head, Irene, visit. Whoever killed Reardon was covering their tracks, which makes you the next loose end to be snipped.
Let it breathe. I've never been in over my head.
Leave now. Disappear. You're good at that. Or stay and volunteer for protective custody.
If I'm in danger, so are you. Come with me. What if we trusted each other?
You're not listening. I'm taking you to either the railway station or the police station.
And he says he's there to warn her that, like, this situation is really shady and she needs to get out of town. Or else he is gonna, like, insist on bringing her to the police so that she can share what she knows with Inspector Lestrade.
Yeah, because things are weird.
Yeah. And she responds by poisoning him.
Yep. As you do.
Yep. She poisons him to knock him unconscious, like, cradles him and kisses him as he falls into unconsciousness, and then strips him naked and handcuffs him to the bed.
And a classic move of, let's get our handsome protagonist naked on screen.
Right. With just a little pillow over his penis.
Yep. So he realizes she's more involved than hoped. Because right. He wants her to be safe. Because he loves her. Because she is the Catwoman to his Batman.
Exactly. You know, mistletoe can be deadly if you eat it. But a kiss can be even deadlier if you mean
it. Maybe we should watch the 66 Batman for the pod.
That movie is good. That movie doesn't really have romance, though.
Yeah, it does.
Does it?
They don't end up together, but Catwoman does a lot of flirting with Bruce Wayne.
All right.
As the Russian journalist.
Right. I forgot about that part. Anyway, also at point 3, Holmes and Watson get arrested at one point, and Mary comes to bail out Watson, but does not bail out Sherlock Holmes because she doesn't like him.
Yep. Good move on her part.
Yep. Point number four. The three of them, Holmes, Watson, and Irene Adler, are in a slaughterhouse?
Yeah. A black magic slaughterhouse. A black magic slaughterhouse. Where they're making cyanide, it turns out.
Yeah. And Mark Strong blows it up, so Watson gets hospitalized, and Holmes goes to see him in disguise in the hospital, and Mary is also there to visit Watson, and she recognizes him, and is basically like, go get those guys for Watson. I know you care about him. The way she says, I know you care about him, again, is kind of like, we're both in love with the same man.
Yeah. And she's also, she recognizes him immediately, which no one else seems to.
Right. He tries to play it off, but she's always on the lookout for her competition.
Right. Oh my
God. So Holmes, eventually joined by Watson, goes to like stop the big plot to gas all of Parliament and put magicians in charge of the Empire.
And take over the United States.
And take over the United States. You know, this is before Theodore Roosevelt's Great White Fleet, so the British would have naval superiority. But in the course of this whole thing, they, like, disable the bomb, but Irene steals the poison gas to take to Professor Moriarty, who she's working for. She had been blackmailed into working for him. She, like, tried to get out of it at one point, and Moriarty was like, oh, no, no, you work for me forever.
Yeah, well, less blackmail and more threatening to murder Holmes, who she loves.
Yeah. It is funny that they, like, didn't want to commit to a Moriarty casting because they wanted to get, like, a movie star for the second one. So Moriarty is always just in, like, comically shadowed areas.
But you know that they redubbed the voice, right?
Yes, but I watched an original release DVD, so it does not have Jared Harris's voice.
Oh, I watched the version with Jared Harris's voice.
Jared Harris also is, like, not what they were going for. They kept trying to get a bigger star, and, like, at the last minute still didn't have one. So Jared Harris was a last-minute casting. And, like, if Jared Harris is your emergency call, you're in pretty good shape.
Right. Yeah, so Holmes chases after her to get the gas back.
During the big fight, Mark Strong, like, kicks her off the bridge. And she falls on another platform.
Yeah, she only falls, like, 5 feet.
So in point number five, after they've defeated Mark Strong and hanged him from the tower bridge.
He hangs himself-ish.
Yes. It's a great the hero doesn't have to kill the bad guy thing.
Yeah, because Holmes does, like, try and stop him from dying. But along the way, a giant, like, chain falls and breaks through the bridge and he hangs to death.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then Holmes and Irene are sitting on the bridge.
Storm's coming.
Well, we've still got a moment.
Moriarty.
What?
That's his name. And he is a professor. Everyone has a weak spot. And he found mine.
Where was it, precisely?
Please don't underestimate. He's just as brilliant as you are, and infinitely more devious.
We'll see about that.
And she tells him about Professor Moriarty, the Napoleon of crime, who is so smart and ruthless that he will kill Sherlock Holmes.
And also try and start World War I, like, 10 years early.
Right. Well, what she really says is she's like, yeah, Moriarty, like, he got to me because he found my weak spot.
My love of you. Blech. Point five.
Well, yeah, other half of point five is Sherlock Holmes has gotten the giant gem from Irene Adler and given it to Watson to turn into a comically large engagement ring.
Just like a British person to steal a diamond stolen by a British person from an Indian Raj.
Exactly. All right, Mark, do you find the romances of Sherlock Holmes believable?
I mean, the Mary John one seems fine.
Basically fine, yeah.
I see
the Irene stuff
is nonsense.
I see,
like, no problem with the Mary John one, because especially since she hasn't met Sherlock yet.
Right. They've clearly had, like, a normal, respectful relationship. If anything, the weirdest part of it is that she hasn't met his, like, best friend, co-worker that he lives with.
Exactly. But we know why.
Right. Holmes is being petulant.
The I read Sherlock part, there's like no chemistry there. It makes no sense.
It really doesn't work. Like, on paper, it's, you know, they were old flames. They're reconnecting at a point where, like, Holmes is adrift. She's recently divorced. And so, like, it kind of makes sense that their feelings resurface. But, like, you want there to be, like, a real, like, sexual spark to that, and there just isn't.
Right. And so, it's they're both such good actors, and yet they just can't pull it off.
Yeah. I don't remember anything about her in the second movie.
She's, like, a bigger part in the second movie.
I know. I just really don't remember that movie. I just remember Jared Harris.
Yeah.
They keep talking about making a third one. Like, at the time, they were like, we're good to go. They hired Drew Pierce to write a third one. Guy Ritchie was going to do it. But Downey got too busy with the MCU once he wasn't just making Iron Man movies. So the movie kept getting delayed. Around the time he was wrapping up his Avengers stuff, they hired Dexter Fletcher to make a movie. But, like, that obviously hasn't happened either. At one point, Downey was talking about, like, making the movie with Warner Brothers and also producing spin-off shows for HBO Max. And, you know, none of this has happened. And I can't find confirmation that it is not happening. But it has not happened.
Yeah. I doubt it'll happen, though.
It seems like it would be weird to do.
I feel like people have soured on this movie some, too.
I think people have forgotten this movie, right? People like Sherlock Holmes, but, like, I don't know that there's a lot of nostalgia or demand for these. I get it at the time, because Game of Shadows makes even more money than this one does.
Right.
But I don't think this is the path forward. I think Downey likes playing the character, though.
Yeah, that tracks. Where would you rate the romance on a 10-point scale?
I don't know, like a 7? 6? 6?
6. That works for me. Do you think any of these people are dateable?
Watson, obviously.
Yeah, Jude Law hot.
Jude Law hot. Mary, fine. No strong opinion.
Yeah, the movie doesn't have any strong opinions about Mary either.
She seems generally nice and supportive, but she'll stand up for herself.
Sherlock and Irene, one's a criminal, the other is weird.
He takes too many drugs for me.
Yeah. Do you think couples will stay together?
Watson and Mary, yes. Holmes and Irene, no.
Yep. If you had to pick one person in the movie to date, who would you pick?
Now, this is a tough one, because it's mostly a movie of scumbags. I feel like I have to go with Watson. You want to be able to say, like, Mrs. Hudson, for example, but this Mrs. Hudson doesn't do that much, and, you know, you can't go there.
I know. It's always tough to pick in a criminal movie.
It's got to be Watson.
It's got to be Watson.
Yeah. Now, Mark, should Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes be adapted into a stage musical?
No.
No, of course not. I don't want to see Holmes sing.
No, I don't want to see a Holmes musical at all.
Certainly not this one.
But I think that's enough Holmes for me
now. I could do with more musicals about the occult.
That, yes. I agree. But I think that's enough Holmes.
All right, well, a nice choice, Mark. I sent you a list of Guy Ritchie movies, and you picked this one.
I was just like, we gotta. Like, it's so weird. But next week, we will be watching a much better film.
I have never seen Some Like It Hot,
you
but I am excited to.
You haven't seen it? Oh my god, you're gonna love it, I think.
I've been sitting on the Criterion Blu-ray for years. And, like, it's the problem of, like, you buy a Blu-ray, and if you don't watch it in, like, the first 2 weeks, it'll sit there forever.
I am so excited for you to watch it.
Me too!
But until then, you can follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at Love the Love Pod, and you can email us questions or movie suggestions at lovethelovepod@gmail.com.
Please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe, especially on Spotify and Apple Podcasts to help other people find the show.
All right, last question. What is the best piece of dating advice we got from Sherlock Holmes?
Oh boy. The longer your friend and your significant other go without meeting each other, the weirder it will be when they do.
My advice? If you have to choose between a scumbag roommate who poisons your dog and a lovely woman who loves you, just go with the lovely woman who loves you and move out.
Indisputable. I forgot to mention that he keeps poisoning the dog.
Yeah.
Gladstone the bulldog.
Ugh. Well, there you go. Until next time, I'm gay.
And I'm a ginger. So between the two of us, we know everything there is to know about romance.
Bye.
Bye.
Who controls the British crown? Who keeps the metric system down? We do. Atlantis off the maps. Who keeps the Martians under wraps? We do. We do. that the electric car? Who makes the Goomberg a star? We do. Who robs a fish of their sight?
Who rigs every Oscar night?